6 a.m. It's probably the best time I've ever had with George Norrie on that show. So believe it or not, even though it airs from midnight to 6 a.m., depending where you are in the country, it does have the largest radio audience of any show out there. And I only had to talk to one person who'd been abducted on board a UFO. So that was a very good opportunity. And George is getting more and more friendly towards our Reasons to Believe ministry. So it was very good. Thank you. And we also got featured in a Christian newspaper in the Boston area. This is Massachusetts and Rhode Island. So you can see the article there. I do want this back after the class is over, but you can all take a look at that. And last night, I finished our two-year project of developing a catalog on the anthropic principle. So I'm going to give you a brief review of the little bit of analysis we've been able to do on it so far. We will be putting it up on the web. It's about 250 pages total of literature search we've done on looking up evidence for the anthropic principle. If you're not familiar with that term, it was coined back in 1971 by the British cosmologist Brandon Carter. And it refers to the fact that when astronomers observe the universe, it appears to have all these exquisitely fine-tuned characteristics that makes life possible, in human life in particular. Hence, they refer to it as the anthropic principle. At last count, there's been over 100 books written on this anthropic principle. And however, no one has ever undertaken to develop a catalog of evidences for it. You know, we were the first to do it, and the best I've seen anywhere else is in a book by Frank Tipler and John Barrow, published in 1986, called The Cosmological Anthropic Principle, but they only gave a list of about 22 or 3 evidences for this design feature of the universe. So, but this fits right in with our lesson in the sense that, we've been going through the Bible, looking at all those verses that refer to what the Belgic Confession refers to as the second book that God has given us. He's given us, of course, the words of the Bible, but according to the Belgic Confession, God has granted us a second book, the Book of Nature. And for the past few months, we've been going through the verses in the Bible that talk about this Book of Nature and how we're to use it. And a few of the verses we've been looking at that actually pertain to the anthropic principle is this one of the Psalm 104, verse 24. We studied this a while ago. How many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. And what this verse is promising us is that a study of creation will yield overwhelming evidence for a supernatural, superintelligent creator. And then following that, we have Ecclesiastes 3:11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. And this is a promise that when God designs, He gives us optimality. God's designs are always optimal. However, we're not going to be able to plumb the depth of the elegance of God's designs no matter how much we study the record of nature, which means that we scientists will never be unemployed. There will always be more to learn, always be more to search, according to the book of Ecclesiastes, more to discover about the elegance and the optimality of God's designs. Ecclesiastes 8:17, I saw all that God has done. Despite all his efforts to search it out, man cannot discover its meaning. Even if a wise man claims he knows, he cannot really comprehend it. Which means we can never completely understand all of the elegance and the purpose that's behind God's designs. Again, there's always more to learn. And then Habakkuk 2:14, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, which means that the study of this book of nature, the creation, will increasingly reveal more and more evidence for God. And Habakkuk 3:3, His glory filled the heavens, and His praise filled the earth. I look at this as a promise that there's no discipline or study of science that will not reveal God. You know, you can say the astronomers were the first to discover this anthropic principle, but I've seen a number of articles in the British journal Nature saying there's a chemistry anthropic principle, there's a biology anthropic principle. That doesn't matter where you look, you're going to find this evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design. And what I want to demonstrate in reviewing this catalog that we've just completed is that the more you look, the more you're going to find. The more you search it out, the more you'll see. I mean, we just finished our study of Romans 1, where we talk about how people are without excuse because of God. God has revealed himself through clarity through the record of nature, but people choose not to look. But here's the positive side of it. If you look, you'll find. And the more you look, the more you'll find, the more evidence you'll find for the supernatural, super intelligent creator. Now, in review, part of our catalog's broken into three parts, but the first part of the catalog simply looks at the big stuff, the entire universe. Forget the galaxy, the Virgo supercluster of galaxies. Let's just look at the universe as a whole. Look at the universe as a whole and the laws of physics that govern that universe, as it tells us in Jeremiah 33:25. The laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. And we can study those laws. And what we've discovered so far in searching out the literature is that there's 140 different features of the universe as a whole and the physical laws that must be fine-tuned for any kind of physical life to be possible. We're not just talking life as we know it, but any conceivable life form. Now, it actually boils down to what we would call carbon-based life. Because of all the elements we see in the atomic chart, only carbon is going to permit the kind of molecular complexity that would make life possible. So that's really the only assumption that goes in to this conclusion, is that life must be carbon-based. And if it's carbon-based, then there's these 140 different features of the universe and the physical laws that must be fine-tuned. Now, I've been working in this area for about 30 years and publishing on it for about 20 years. And what we got here is a graphic demonstration of how the more you look, the more you study, the more you're going to find. Actually, my first attempt on this was published in 1989, and there were 15 characteristics known at that time that indicated supernatural design for the benefit of light. Second edition of the Fingerprint of God, the first edition is now out of print, has 17. The second edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, feature 26. The third edition, 35. And if you go on our website, you'll see our latest posting, which was completed in 2004, which is 86. But what's in our latest catalog is 140. So you can see just over the past several years, a rather dramatic increase in the evidences for the supernatural design. Now, again, if you look at the secular literature, the most you're going to find is about 10 or 11. But there are actually 140 different features of the universe that must be exquisitely designed. And when we publish our catalog, we'll be listing each one of them, showing you how the design is manifested, and then giving you all the citations to the literature that demonstrate this 140. Now, that's the universe. And we only have 140 because it's rather challenging for astronomers to study the gross features of the universe. You know, its mass, its size. I mean, you have to be able to observe right out to the edge of the universe, all the way back to the beginning of time, to be able to nail down these features. Those are difficult observations to make. Easier observations to make are to study our cluster of galaxies, the galaxy in which we live. Look at our star, the planets in our solar system, planet Earth, and the moon that circles around the Earth. And what we discover is what's called in the scientific literature the heavenly body problem, namely that not any old cluster of galaxies will do. The Virgo supercluster of galaxies has many exquisitely designed features that make life possible in a galaxy within that supercluster. And not only any old galaxy will do, it needs to be a galaxy almost exactly like the Milky Way galaxy. And I've mentioned here in class before that astronomers have been searching for what they call solar twins. stars that are exactly like the sun, but they've yet to find a solar twin. It seems like our star, the sun, is unique in its capacity to be able to sustain a planet that would have life existing upon it. And as it turns out, every single planet in our solar system plays a role in making life possible here on planet Earth. So next time you turn your binoculars on the planet Neptune, don't take it for granted. Neptune's at exactly the right distance with exactly the right orbit, exactly the right mass to make life possible here on planet Earth. That's true as well of the other planets. Pluto doesn't matter that much, but I noticed Pluto got demoted. On the other hand, the Kuiper Belt, which is that belt of asteroids and comets that exists beyond the orbit of Neptune, that too must be exquisitely fine-tuned. But wasn't for the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud that exists far beyond it, life would not be possible here on planet Earth. And I've mentioned here in class, too, a book about 400 pages long called What If the Moon Did Not Exist? And it was written by a guy who's not a Christian, yet he documents throughout this 400-page book dozens of characteristics of the moon that make life possible here on planet Earth. So yeah, the moon is more than just for romance. It's also for understanding and appreciating just how much God loves us in the way he crafted the moon just right for us. Now, the principle here, again, is the more we look, the more we're going to find. And this is a way that we can put creation to the test. This is the point I make in my book, Creation of Science. That if we were to presume that there is no creator behind this universe, no one has designed the universe for the benefit of life and human beings, then we would expect that the more research we do in astronomy and other disciplines like physics and geology, that divine design evidences would decrease both in strength and number. What I mean by strength is the degree of fine-tuning that we see to make life possible would become weaker and weaker, less and less impressive as we learn more and more. And bottom line, the evidence that Jesus Christ is the designer of the universe for the benefit of life would get progressively weaker and weaker as we learn more and more. Well, let's presume that the atheists and agnostics are wrong and that we Christians are right. You'll get the opposite. The more research we do from a scientific perspective, we would see that the evidences for supernatural design would increase in strength and number, and the evidence that Christ is a designer will get progressively stronger and stronger. Now, if you're wondering why we're making a more impressive case than what is typical in the intelligent design movement, it's because we explicitly identify Jesus Christ as a designer. And when you do that, you're able to come up with a much more detailed test of whether or not Christ is the designer, or there is no designer at all, or there's some other designer. Okay, what I'm going to review for you again, we've been publishing these design evidences on the universe all the way back since 1989, and actually even earlier in papers. It goes back even to the late 1970s. However, the first time I put into print these design evidences based on our galaxy and our solar system was in January of 1995, in the second edition of The Creator and the Cosmos. And there's a reason why we were hesitant to do it. And that's because, there's dependency factors that are difficult to calculate because one characteristic may be somewhat dependent on another characteristic. And therefore, it's not legitimate to say, well, we're going to simply multiply the probability of one characteristic being within the right range with the probability for the other characteristic. Now, sometimes that works. For example, the mass of the sun is an independent parameter from the distance that the Earth is from the sun. So the Earth must be a certain distance from the sun for life to be possible. Literally, if you were to move the Earth 0.5% closer to the sun or 0.5% farther away, that would be enough to disturb the possibility of the planet being able to support life. So you can calculate the probability. What's the probability that any planet would happen to fit within that just right zone? Well, it's about one chance in 10,000. So you can multiply that probability with the probability that you're going to get a star of the just right mass that makes life possible. And here again, astronomers have discovered if you were to change the mass of the sun by about 0.1%, then life would not be possible on planet Earth. Again, what is the probability of finding a star that's within that mass range? Well, it's less than one chance in a million, so you can take one chance in a million, multiply it by one chance in 10,000, and that gives you one chance in 10 billion that you'll get both. That's kind of how these calculations proceed. But you can't do that in every single case. What you have to do in many cases is calculate the dependency factors. And then there's also another way in that some of these factors have to be held constant for a very long period of time, literally billions of years. And so what that does is actually make the probability less probable than you would otherwise think. That, too, is difficult to calculate. And then back in the 90s, there was a question about how many planets might exist in the observable universe. Carl Sagan said 10 billion trillion. Astronomers today say that it's a lot less than 10 billion trillion, quite a bit less. But that was an issue, too. What we did in 1995 is we said, you know, somebody's got to get this ball rolling. And so we made a first stab at it with all kinds of disclaimers as to how difficult it is to actually come up with these kinds of numbers. And fortunately, a number of astronomers checked my numbers, and they came up at least within the same ballpark. So that made us felt that it was all right to put it into print. But in January of 1995, we published 41 different characteristics of our galaxy, solar system, and planet that must be fine-tuned for life to be possible here on planet Earth, and accounting for the dependency factors as best we could, and the maximum number of planets, we decided to go with Carl Sagan's absurdly optimistic estimate, just to be conservative. We concluded that the probability that you're going to find a body anywhere in the observable universe with the capacity to support life without invoking miraculous intervention was less than one chance in 10 to the 31. Now, that's 31 zeros after the 1. Small number. Small enough number that you'd say it's highly unlikely that indeed we have such a miracle-free planet. However, we redid this in October of 2000. This is the date when we sent off the third edition of the Crater and the Cosmos to the publisher. And notice, instead of 41 characteristics, we now have 128, and the probability is now less than one chance in 10 to the 144. And this made our Reasons to Believe ministry feel confident about claiming that Jesus Christ indeed must be the Creator, because in physics, if you can show that something has a probability of less than one chance in 10 to the 50th of happening, that's the same as proving that it's impossible. No physicist believes in the possibility of anything happening that's got a possibility of less than one chance in 10 to the 50th of taking place. To put that number into context, the total number of protons and neutrons in the observable universe is only 10 to the 78. And so the probability is actually far more remote that you're going to find a planet with the capacity to support life without invoking a supernatural creator than it would be the blindfolded you could pick out one proton out of the 10 to the 78 protons to fill the entire observable universe. Far less remote. Okay, May of 2002 is where you'll find a posting on our website, and now we're looking at 202 characteristics, and the probability is less than one chance in 10 to the 217. And the last posting we have is April of 2004, 322 characteristics, and the probability is less than one chance in 10 to the 282. Now, what does all this mean? All the way up to April of 04, and this is what we published in the Creation of Science. You'll see all these numbers in there. What this means is that the probability that Jesus Christ supernaturally designed our galaxy cluster, our galaxy, our solar system, for the benefit of life, and I'm talking bacterial life, not human life, just the very simplest life form, that probability gets 100,000 times stronger every single month. That means with 30 days, the evidence gets 100,000 times stronger than it was a month previously that Jesus Christ supernaturally designed the planet for the benefit of life. Now, having finished the catalog, we now appreciate that that conclusion is extremely conservative, because this is our latest effort. November of 2006 is when we finished our literature search. Now we're looking at 676 characteristics that must be exquisitely fine-tuned, and the probability is less than 1 chance in 10 to the 556. So we got about a 2.5-year span here, and notice that the list of characteristics that must be designed has doubled in size, and the probability, again, has gotten much more dramatic. We literally added almost 300 zeros after the 1. And so this kind of gives you a demonstration, again, showing that the more you look, the more evidence you're going to find. The more you search, the more you're going to find. Now, I'm not quite in a position to say that the evidence gets a trillion times stronger a month, because actually this is somewhat distorted in the sense that throughout this 11-year period, our reasons to believe research team has been growing. In the old days, I did this all by myself, and I had to carry out the rest of the ministry all by myself, which meant I wasn't able to read all the journals that I normally read. And what's happened since then is in 2006, we have 3 astronomers on staff, and I've been able to delegate to those astronomers a lot of my normal duties, and therefore, for the first time, I've actually been able to do somewhat close to a complete literature search, which I've not been able to do previous to 2004. So it's only in the last 2 years that you could say that our literature search was in any way exhaustive, and even then we're not claiming that it's exhaustive. Yes. No. There's many more characteristics than the 676. These are the 676 where we understand it deeply enough that we can actually see the level of fine-tuning. I mean, a big part of this catalog is a list of over 400 features of our galaxy and solar system, where we say if you were to make this characteristic, characteristics value this much bigger or this much smaller, these are the catastrophes that would happen that would make life impossible. So in over 400 cases, we're able to actually come up with those kinds of upper and lower limits that establish, you know, when the catastrophe takes place. In the other cases, we know that it's fine-tuned, but we're not able to actually determine exactly where those limits lie. Or in some cases, only the upper limit applies or only the lower limit applies. The catalog I have here is limited to those characteristics where you got both an upper limit and a lower limit, and where we got some idea what the values are for those limits. So what this is really showing is our limited knowledge and expertise at this point in our research. However, you are on to an interesting point, that a lot of characteristics that I'd noted earlier and said, I can't tell if it's designed or not, now astronomers are able to research it sufficiently where we say, okay, where we couldn't see the design previously, we can see the design now. And so you're kind of onto something, and it's an impression I have in completing this catalog that everything is designed, if only we could understand it with enough depth. It's just that, you know, most of the characteristics we look at, we can't see the design today. Yes. They're not all strictly independent. Many of them are. However, the probability that I've listed there, 1 chance in 10 to the 556, takes into account the dependency factors. I mean, if I were to assume that they were strictly independent, I would have 1,000 zeros after the 1. But then I go through the whole thing and try to conservatively estimate what the dependency factors are. And where I don't know, completely independent, well over 100. So, you know, it's but a lot of the cases, we just can't see exactly where the dependency lies. But where I can't see it, then I try to very generously estimate in favor of the atheist, so that when they go through it, they would say, okay, you've not underestimated these dependency factors. Now, When you read the scientific literature on the anthropic principle, the thing I notice is that they focus only on the most primitive life. And we call it the anthropic principle, which is this idea that the universe is designed for humanity. But if you actually read the secular books on the anthropic principle, they don't interpret it that way. I really haven't seen anything outside of our organization that looks at these astronomical characteristics from the standpoint of human beings. Exclusively, they're in the context of the most primitive life of all. And actually, in the case of the most primitive life, it exists for a very brief period of time. Now, again, as we've gone through this study of the verses in the Bible that pertain to what's called general revelation, this book of nature, what it tells us is that God designed this planet, this universe, specifically for the benefit of human beings. And therefore, from a Christian perspective, we would expect that you'd actually see more design evidence for human beings than you would, say, for an amoeba. And so what we've done by way of analysis is to compare bacteria versus human beings. Now, again, when I look at my collection of textbooks on the anthropic principle, almost all of them are in the context, in fact, I think every one of them, outside of the books we produce, is in the context of the first, what we call brief bacteria. And you say, what do you mean by brief? This would be some planet existing somewhere in the universe that would have the capacity to support one or two bacterial species for about 3 months. In other words, they don't worry about the life forms consuming the nutrients and running out of nutrients, and therefore setting up some cycling process to recycle the nutrients. And what you notice is that it's much easier to set up a situation where you would have bacteria existing for a few months. Matter of fact, you could take bacteria from planet Earth and probably drop it on a few planetary bodies and have that bacteria exist for a few days without much trouble. But I chose the time span of 90 days. So this calculation here, you still notice there are 501 different characteristics that must be fine-tuned in order to allow the simplest of bacterial life forms to exist for a 90-day period. Now, in the next category, we've got what's called permanent bacteria. And by what I mean by permanent is something on the order of 3 billion years. So the possibility of finding a planet, and by the way, I'm focusing on planets because a research paper got published about a year and a half ago that ruled out moons as a possibility. For a long time, astronomers were speculating that maybe the moons of Jupiter or the moons of other planets might be suitable sites for life. But a study now shows that there's a limit to how big of a moon can orbit about a particular planet. And the size of that moon is too small to support any kind of life, even brief bacteria life. But the second listing you see there, permanent bacteria, that's 3 billion years versus 3 months. And now, in order to keep bacteria alive for 3 billion years, you need an ecosystem of bacteria. Because bacteria aren't going to live very long unless you've got other bacteria that are processing nutrients and cycling the nutrients throughout the environment. Particularly nitrogen must be effectively cycled throughout the environment. You need an ocean now in order to make that possible, that cycling. It's important that dust be deposited on that water, which means you're going to need continents. So if all you're talking about is bacteria for 3 months, you don't need continents. All you need is liquid water. But if you're talking 3 billion years, you're going to need oceans and continents together with an appropriate rotation period and plate tectonics and all the rest. And now you can see that the probability is about 10 to the 250 times more remote that you're going to find a place that's able to support bacteria for a long period of time. And then you get down to human beings. And by the way, when I talk about human beings, it's simply human beings or the functional equivalent. We're talking about some species of life that would be capable of developing civilization. So it doesn't have to be exactly like us, but enough like us that they would have the dexterity and the intelligence that they could build, say, villages and roads. And now the probability, now you've got more than 1,000 zeros after the one. Yes. we're not talking about the origin of life. The origin of life is a totally separate calculation. We're just saying, if you were to place life on this planet, would it survive? Could it last 90 days before being brought to extinction? So, by the way, there's quite a few places you could go where life could last for 1 second. But if you meet the requirement 90 days, that means it's got to be able to respirate and so forth. Mars, for example, you could put a bacteria on the planet of Mars, and it will stay alive for about 1 or 2 seconds before it goes dead. Right. Well, yeah, there you're looking at probabilities that would require 100 billion zeros after the one. That would be to go to a planet and have the chemistry of that planet produce the simplest independent living life form. A famous calculation done by the biochemist Harold Morowitz, actually it's 25 years ago he did this, where he took the simplest bacterium that we could find on planet Earth, and it turns out that simplest bacterium is the simplest life form as possible given the laws of physics. You need to have a minimum number of proteins in order for an organism to be able to live independently, and it turns out the simplest life form on planet Earth is about that simple. And if you break all the chemical bonds in that life form and then keep all the chemical residue in a box where you let nothing foreign come in and nothing that's essential escape, and keep it under ideal chemical conditions for reassembly, Harold Morowitz calculated you would have to wait 10 to the 100 billion years for it to put itself back together. And that poses a challenge because protons decay in only 10 to the 33 years. And so you wouldn't have the molecules after just 10 to the 33 years or the atoms. Yes. Yes, but on Mars you've got radiation, you have the problem of water evaporating. What basically kills life on Mars is it desiccates. The water escapes very quickly and then the life form is dead. Yes, I mean if you desiccate the creature very quickly, of course a hard vacuum you're going to have desiccating conditions too. Yeah, so... there are a couple of bacterial life forms that can exist under hard radiation conditions. The bacterium called Subtilis that can handle hard radiation. And if you keep it inside a grain where it's not going to lose its water, it can withstand that radiation literally for a few months. Things can bring it back to life. They've done experiments like that on the space shuttle. However, it's really quite irrelevant to the origin of life because these are creatures of extremely low metabolism, have very high protein repair mechanism, which is why they're able to handle such harsh radiation. But their metabolic rate is extremely slow as a result. And even then, they will die if you keep them under those radiation conditions long enough. Well, I mean, we've got we're bigger. So, I mean, you can lose a bunch of cells on your skin, and it's not going to kill you. It's the whole thing about if you're out in a blizzard, who's going to die first? The skinniest guy is going to die first because he's got a large surface area with not much mass. Likewise, bacteria are at the bottom of the pile in terms of, large surface area to the volume. So, all right. Okay, conclusion. What this demonstrates is that we see orders of magnitude more design required for human beings than we do for the simplest life form. But it also shows that the scientific community is really underestimating dramatically the evidence for the anthropic principle, since their whole focus is on category one brief bacteria. And even then, they're not looking at all the characteristics. I say that in response to a book we have there on the table, Rare Earth, written by an atheist and agnostic, an atheist paleontologist and agnostic astronomer. we interviewed the agnostic astronomer Brownlee on our webcast, and you can listen to that. It's still posted. But what they note in the book is that they believe that bacterial life is common in the universe and human life exists only in planet Earth, because they note that you need a whole lot more design for human beings than you do the bacteria. But when they say that bacteria is common, they're referring to brief bacteria, not talking about planets where you've got bacteria for billions of years, but planets where you have it for only a few months. And they were not looking at 501 characteristics. They were looking at four or five characteristics. And so they grossly underestimated all the characteristics that needed to be fine-tuned. And you look at our catalog, where they probably did the greatest underestimate is they didn't realize all the design you need in our galaxy. They basically focused on the design you need in our solar system and on planet Earth in particular, and ignored all the evidence on the galaxy. But actually, we found the most dramatic design evidence is on our galaxy and our supercluster of galaxies. Yes. Yeah, that's a minus, which is kind of a shorthand notation for one chance in 10 to the 1,032. So that means it's a 0.000, where you got 1,031 zeros between the decimal point and one. So yeah, it's a real tiny probability. To put that in context, let me see if I can do the calculation in my head. It would be equivalent to your winning the California lottery 125 consecutive times, where you buy one ticket each time. That's the probability that you're going to find a body anywhere in the observable universe with the capacity to support human life or the functional equivalent thereof. So figure out your probability of winning the California lottery 125 consecutive times, where you buy just one ticket each time. It's roughly equivalent to the probability of winning 125 consecutive times where you don't buy any tickets at all. Yes. Right. Well, that's what we're predicting, is that come 2008, these probabilities will get even more remote than they are on this chart here. But what we've been able to do over the past 20 years is show, just by our own study, how dramatically the evidence improves as you learn more and more. But yeah, from a biblical perspective, taking the principle that nothing in God's creation is wasted, we would expect that everything, every feature is going to show design. It's just that we can't see the design in all these features because we lack the measuring capability. And this dramatically demonstrates that the more we can see, the more we can measure, the more we can understand, the more evident that design becomes. And it's in astronomy, by the way, where you find the greatest acceptance for the conclusion that the universe, in some respect, has been supernaturally designed to make life possible. Although you'll seldom see the word supernatural. What you'll see instead is a term that there must be something transcendent that explains why the universe has these amazing characteristics. Yes. Well, essentially what we're doing here is the Drake equation. But we're putting real numbers in instead of just guess numbers. I don't know where Frank Drake stands at this moment. Everything I've seen published in the Drake equation yields the same optimistic probabilities that Frank Drake and Carl Sagan published in the 1960s. So from what I can tell, it's not been updated. If you're not familiar with this term, the Drake equation, it was produced in 1960 by a Cornell astronomer. The guy was the professor for Carl Sagan's PhD thesis. And Frank Drake was the one who said, let's see if we can calculate how many intelligent civilizations exist in our galaxy. And he said, you know, we don't know a lot, but let's take a stab at it. And that's kind of what we're doing here. We're taking a stab at it. Only we claim our stab's a little bit better than Frank Drake's stab. And the stab he took was as follows. Well, let's look at our solar system. how many planets exist in our solar system? At the time, there were nine. And he said, how many have life on it? Well, one out of nine. So he said, let's just assume the probability is that one planet out of ten will have life on it, based on what we see in the solar system. So that's one chance in ten. And he said, well, let's assume that one planet that has life on it, out of ten planets that have life on it, one of them have intelligent life on it. Which means if you take 100 planets, one of them is going to have intelligent life. But he also noted that intelligent life can't survive very long. So he said, of those that have intelligent life, how many would have intelligent life now? And he says, well, we have no idea. Let's assume it's 1 in 10. And so that's where they get these extremely optimistic conclusions that there's a million planets in our galaxy that would have intelligent life on it with the enough technology that they'd be able to communicate with us. But the question is, are the probabilities reliable, one chance in 10? Today we know a lot more than we did in 1960, and we can actually calculate. For one thing, we've discovered 200 planets outside of our solar system. Not one of those planetary systems has the characteristics that would allow any kind of life to exist. So at the very least, Frank Drake should say, well, instead of 1 out of 10, it's 1 out of 210. And maybe we discover, and right now there is a satellite that was launched by the French to look for more extrasolar planets. And I predict that when they discover 1,000, we'll still have only one planet out of 1,000 with the capacity to support life. So again, that simply would demonstrate a principle here. The more you learn, the more you study, the more you're going to find. Well, back in 1986, Paul Davies, an astrophysicist from Britain, wrote a book on the anthropic principle. And he declared himself in the opening chapter to be agnostic. Nevertheless, he concluded the book by saying, based on only about 15 characteristics that show design, not the hundreds that we have, but just literally a handful. And he says, based on this 15, it seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers. And the second to last sentence in the book, the impression of design is overwhelming. Now, in terms of those astronomers that have actually tried to look at more than just a handful of these design characteristics, what are they saying? And again, Paul Davies has come up with a new book, and he says we have two choices. Either the Christians are right, that there's a transcendent, supernatural, superintelligent being that's responsible for all this design, or there's hidden laws of physics that spontaneously produce the design that we're seeing. But what I want you to notice is both of these answers are appealing to something beyond the universe that we see. And, you know, my critique of the hidden laws of physics, how can you hide them? If there's laws out there that are capable of spontaneously producing this design, there's no way astronomers would not see those laws of physics. And, you know, basically the appeal of Paul Davies and Stuart Kaufman is that there are exotic sites in the universe where physics behaves very differently than what we see around us. On the other hand, that violates the anthropic principle, which states that life is possible only in a universe that's extremely homogeneous and uniform. Now, if it's extremely homogeneous and uniform, that means there's no possibility for exotic sites. Everywhere we look, the physics and the chemistry will behave the same way. And incidentally, as we peer through our telescopes, that's exactly what we see. We observe homogeneity and uniformity all over the universe. The same mix of elements that we see here exists all over the universe. So it tells us there's nothing exotic out there yet. While dark matter is one of these exquisitely fine-tuned characteristics, you know, when we first started working on this back in the 1980s, we did it without any conception of the dark stuff at all. One reason why we see such spectacular numbers today is astronomers have been able to actually detect the dark stuff and determine a nature design in that dark stuff that's very, very impressive. In fact, I would say the most spectacular evidence we have for supernatural design is in the dark stuff, not the stuff that we, quote, see light coming from. Exotic dark matter, and particularly dark energy, is where we see the most spectacular evidence. So of all those characteristics, 1,000 whatever characteristics. By the way, for the human beings, I don't think I showed this on here. the probability was actually less than one chance in 10^1,333 before we started looking at the dependency factors. But of these 816 features, by far the most dramatic is the design you need in the dark energy, and the second one is the design you need in the exotic dark matter. For those of you who aren't aware of this, the universe that we see, the light that you see coming through the telescope, that's only 0.27% of the universe. 99.73% of the universe is dark stuff. And by the way, the one that said it first is Job. 38th chapter of Job, there's a whole paragraph there on darkness, where God asked the five assembled philosophers there, Job and his four friends, what do you know about darkness? Do you know where it resides? Do you know what it's all about? Can you go there? Can you show me the path of darkness? Well, it took a long time. Only a year ago, we were in a position to answer those questions that Job asked more than 3,000 years ago. But it's interesting that it's in that book of Job. It's the only holy book that talks about darkness as a thing that's in the universe. And today we realize that what Job has said is true. Moreover, it's where we find the most spectacular evidence. And this has been a goal of mine literally for 20 years, is to produce this kind of catalog. And so we'll do what we can to keep the catalog up to date and let you know what's happening. But it dramatically demonstrates a lot of what we've been studying about in this class in the book of Habakkuk and Psalms, as well as Job. Let me get our lesson up here. I mean, what did the disciples do without PowerPoint? Okay. Let me move through here. For those of you that are guests, we've been looking at this for a few months now. And looking at all the stuff about the Belgic Confession. And looking through. This is the number. These are the verses, by the way, I've been referring to. The verses in the Bible that talk about general revelation. And we're almost through our study here, looking at all of what the Bible says about general revelation. And, sorry, I can't go any faster through this PowerPoint than this. And we're actually in the New Testament. And a couple of weeks ago, we were in Romans 1. We finished up Romans 1. And Romans 1 is interesting in that it explains why it is that people have such difficulty reading this book of nature. And it's because they're committed to deny God in the first place. And we went through a study of what happens when you're on this path of trying to deny God, how you become an impaired scientist. That's the first consequence of denying God. And this is a little review of what happens to impair your ability to read this book of nature and to do good science. Are probably even more devastating, you become an impaired lover. And what we found to be rather interesting is how the steps that lead to your impairment, your ability to love and experience intimacy with your fellow human beings, is identical to the steps of those things that impair your capacity to do science, which led me to the interesting little joke that if you want to be a good lover, you've got to be a good scientist. Okay. Or maybe it's the other way around. To be a good scientist, you have to be a good lover. And likewise, we fail to see intimacy connections. And anyway, and then you become an impaired thinker. And that's where we ended up a couple of weeks ago. And then last week, we got into Romans chapter 2, which actually talks about a third book that God has given us. Actually, there's several books that God has given us. You know, in the Belgic Confession, it talks about the two big books. The 66 books of the Bible, and the book of nature, and all the disciplines of science that study the book of nature. But there are other books as well. And Romans 2 talks about a book that God has written upon our heart. how at the point of conception, God writes his law in the heart of every human being. You want to know when life begins from a biblical perspective? It begins at that moment that God writes his law on the heart of a human being, which takes place at the point of conception. I want to read a text on it, Psalm 51, verse 5, where King David talks about how he was a sinner from the time he was conceived. And how can one note that he is a sinner unless that law that God has given has been written on their heart? And this really explains why we see the elements of the Ten Commandments in every religion of the world. After all, every human being's got the same law written on their heart. And so we all possess that conscience, and the conscience shouts of our need for redemption. As we mentioned last week, what this law tells us is the standard of moral performance that God expects. And the more you try to live up to the standards of your conscience, the more persuaded you will be by your conscience that you're falling short of God's standard, and that God's standard is one of moral perfection. And so this is what points every human being in the direction of their need for a Redeemer. Because after all, if we try to satisfy God's standards by our own human effort, we're not going to make it. We're going to fall short. We can't even control our actions, let alone our words or our thoughts. And that's what Jesus' message in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, God's going to judge you, not just for your actions, but even what you're thinking. And who of us can claim to have perfect thoughts all the time? And that's the whole point. The conscience is consistently accusing us of our incapacity to live up to the standard that God expects for us, which means there's got to be some other means for us to receive redemption than our own human effort. Well, the passage we want to talk about right now is Romans 10, which actually gets us into a fourth book. And maybe there's other books. I don't know how many books God has given us, but there's at least four that have been revealed in Scripture. And this is actually a hearkening back to Psalm 19, which we studied a few months back. And Paul is answering a question here. And what I want to do is actually read to you the whole context of Romans chapter 10. It begins in verse 14. It says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. How then can they call on the one they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one of whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. But not all the Israelites accepted the good news. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed our message? Consequently, faith comes from hearing the message, and the message is heard through the word of Christ. But I ask, and here's our text, did they not hear? Of course they did. Their voice has gone out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. And here Paul is quoting from Psalm 19. Again I ask, did Israel not understand? First Moses says, I will make you envious by those who are not a nation. I'll make you angry by a nation that has no understanding. And Isaiah boldly says, I was found by those who did not seek me. I revealed myself to those who did not ask for me. But concerning Israel, he says, all day long I've held out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. And so what Paul is doing here in the 10th chapter, he's kind of reviewing everything that he has said in chapters 1, 2, and 3 about how God reaches out to humanity. And there's a lot here in the sense that he, first of all, makes the point that how can you believe unless someone preaches and teaches? But the point he's making here is that God sends out preachers and teachers. And what I find interesting is not all of these preachers and teachers are saved individuals. Sometimes God speaks to us about our need for redemption through people who don't even know the gospel, haven't even received the gospel yet. And a few weeks back I conducted a funeral for my father. I told a story in that funeral upon my dad quoted a verse out of the Bible, out of the book of Proverbs. There is a way which seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. He had no idea it was from the Bible. He had no idea where it came from, period. He heard it somewhere, I guess, and repeated it. He only said it once in his entire life, and it happened when I was 13 years of age. But I told the story of my dad's funeral, how that statement that came out of my dad's mouth I had no idea where it was from, but it kept eating away at me. It kept making me think. And there was a point in my late teenage years when I really resolved to live a very moral life. And suddenly that verse came back to me and I realized, no, that's the way of death. That's not the way of life. And so God was able to use my father. And I actually saw God use my father in another context. There was one time I did an outreach in Vancouver, up in the mountains there overlooking the city, beautiful restaurant. Hundreds of people were there. And after the message, I saw my dad at the back. And he was arguing with a bunch of atheists. And he had actually shared the gospel message with these atheists. And some of them responded. And they gave their lives to Christ. So I eagerly talked to my dad afterwards and said, did you do something you haven't told me about yet? He says, no, son, I'm not a Christian. I said, well, can you explain what's going on? He says, well, I know it's what they need. I'm just not ready for it myself. So... But if you read the missionary annals, you'll see that this happens all over the world, where God preaches through people who are not necessarily believers and gets people thinking and searching. Maybe it's not the gospel message, but it's kind of like that statement my dad said, just gets people thinking. And Don Richardson, in his book Eternity in Our Hearts, makes note of the fact that God places within every culture what he refers to as historical redemptive analogies, actually builds into the culture of every civilization and society societal practices that actually have a redemptive message built into it. I mean, we read in the Old Testament how they had these six cities of refuge, and what's interesting is you can go into these primitive tribes all over the world and you see that they have that concept built in. And those cities of refuge was one of the ways that God was getting across to the Jews. Now, the Jews had this. They had the law. And yet what we notice is Moses and Joshua and setting up the Jewish nation set it up in such a way that God would not only preach through the Bible, there'd be preaching through the cultural norms that were set up, these cities of refuge and other things, the whole way of the temple being set up. There was redemptive analogies built all the way through. In fact, what's really fun is to actually go to a Jewish Seder and recognize that within the Jewish Seder, the Passover Seder, are elements of the Seder that point to the Messiah as the Redeemer. It's all built in. And the Jews don't see it. And that's the whole point here in Romans 10, is that people have the greatest difficulty appreciating and understanding these books are the people that are closest to, quote, the truth. And that's a comment we read, and I think it was out of Habakkuk, where it says that God reaches out to a people far away, and it's people that are far away from the Christian context that actually have the easiest time in reading the record of nature. And I personally got to see that when I was in Africa teaching Muslims there, not Muslims, Hindus, and how the Hindus there didn't really need me to tell them what was wrong with their religion. They all knew that their religion wasn't right. They didn't know why it wasn't right, and they weren't sure of what was right, but they knew something was fundamentally wrong with what they were taught. It was one of the easiest audiences I ever got to address. I mean, virtually the entire audience of Hindu students responded to the gospel message afterwards. What it revealed to me is that God plants within their culture aspects that tell them that there's something fundamentally wrong with this idea. And what was really interesting about these university students, they said Hinduism tells us that everything is contradictory, that everything we study here at the university tells us everything is consistent. And so that told us that Hinduism had to be fatally flawed somewhere, because we do live in a universe that is consistent, everything fits together. And the Christian message really preaches that. The voice has gone out into all the earth, the words to the ends of the world. Everyone has heard, and Paul makes the point, but often those that are most receptive to hearing the truth are those that don't have this book, those that are far away from the churches and the synagogues. They're the ones that are able to appreciate this. Often the greatest resistance to this exists right here in the church. And I'm sad to say this as I go around the country and the world and talk about this book of nature. It's the church that seems most resistant to hearing this message that God is preaching to us. His message is salvation through the records of nature. And this is a point we see in Colossians 1:23. This is the last verse we're looking at. And as this gospel that you heard that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven. You know, a myth that's going around the church is that the only way you're ever going to figure out the gospel is if you read and study this book. And actually, according to what this book says, that's not true. God preaches his gospel, explains his gospel through all of his books. So it's in the cultural analogies, the redemptive analogies that are built into the culture. You can figure it out from the moral law that's been written on your heart, your conscience. It's in the book of nature. And it's also in this book. Now, I will agree, this book states it most explicitly and clearly and repeatedly. However, it's in all the other books that God has given us as well. It's not just the Bible that preaches this gospel. And now, what I want to do next week is really get into exactly how the book of nature preaches this gospel, how it lays it out. And I'm going to do it from the context of the Bible. I'll show you how individuals in the Bible, without benefit of this book, were able to figure out the gospel message through their examination of this book of nature. So the Belgic Confession, again, makes the point that God has given us two books, and that all the creatures and all the objects in the universe are like letters and sentences and paragraphs in a book. And in one sense, my little introduction at the beginning is a demonstration of all the individual stars, the planets, the creatures that are here on the earth, are like words and sentences explaining to us how God has carefully prepared this universe for our benefit. Now, that doesn't speak of God's love, how he created 10 billion trillion stars. Actually, that number is a bit of an underestimate. It's 50 billion trillion stars that we can count in the observable universe. Thanks to the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, we've got a pretty good number on the total stars in the observable universe. But every one of those stars is critical for us to be able to exist on this planet. I told you before, if you take a single dime and add it to the mass of the universe, or take a single dime and subtract it from the mass of the universe, that's enough to disturb the balance. And life will not be possible. Not even bacterial life will be possible if you were to add one dime or subtract one dime from the total mass of the observable universe. That's so delicately fine-tuned it is. By the way, that's just one of the 144 characteristics that must be fine-tuned. There's 139 more. And by the way, I didn't give you my best example. Now, there are other characteristics of the universe where the fine-tuning is even more dramatic than that. Yes. Well, we are made from the dust of the earth. It's the dust that must be fine-tuned. If you add to that, he took what was here, right? Well, I mean, as it says of us human beings, there's something about us that God made from what previously existed. But there's also something about us that that's no part of the universe at all. The spirit within us has nothing to do with the physics of the universe. And God did both when he created human beings. And likewise, he did that when he created the higher animals. The soulishness of the higher animals is not something he made from the dust of the earth. That's something that transcends the matter and energy of the universe. Which, by the way, is something that Darwinists never bothered to consider. Where did the higher creatures get their self-will? Where did they get their emotional capacity? It's not in the genes. Yes. Question. I can see you're worried. Actually, if you were to take a dime's worth away from the universe today, it probably wouldn't make that much difference. It does make a huge difference, however, when the universe is young. And whether or not you get the elements that would make possible a Jim Constantian very much depends on what mass density the universe manifests in its youth, what it has right now. Now, I'm saying that from ignorance. It could be there's something about that mass density that's critical even today. But we do know for sure that you're not going to get the uranium, the thorium, the magnesium in the right proportions in a stable enough fashion that you could make a gym constantion unless you have the universe exactly with the right mass density tuned to within one part in 10 to the 60th. Right. Well, the dark energy is one part in 10 to the 120th. It's far more spectacular again. So, but my whole point is, when you look at all that, how can you escape the conclusion that God loves us? I mean, if he made all that just so that we could exist. And by the way, one thing you'll see in our catalog is all these bacteria we see in the face of the earth are very critical for our existence. And there's a reason why you only see bacteria for 3 billion years. Those bacteria are working overtime to prepare the planet for human beings. And like with bacteria, there's a 4 billion year wide window in which they can exist on planet Earth. The window in which we can exist is only 100,000 years wide. So I've been getting a lot of interviews on global warming. One thing I've been trying to point out to all these global warming fans of Al Gore is that these exceptionally benign conditions that would allow global high-tech human civilization exists for just the briefest window of time. And no matter what we human beings do, we're not going to be able to change that. There are natural cycles that are going on that means that, hey, an ice age is coming. I can guarantee you that an ice age is coming. We've been able to put it off with some of our global warming, but there's going to come a time when that ice age will hit. And there will also come a time when the sun will no longer be in an exceptionally luminosity phase. There's a 100,000-year window when the sun is almost exactly middle age, when it has an exceptionally stable luminosity. That window opened up 50,000 years ago. Now, if you read our book, Who Is Adam? When were human beings created? 50,000 years ago, at the very beginning of that window of time. How much longer will that window of time stay open in terms of stable luminosity stability? Just 50,000 more years. Now, after that, you can still have life. In fact, you can still have human life. You just won't be able to have global human civilization. So if we go back to a population of a few tens of thousands and back to a Stone Age culture, we'll be fine. But most people aren't quite content to live that way. So in terms of being able to sustain the kind of standard of living we have today and global civilization, God placed us here at exactly the right time in cosmic history, 13.73 billion years after the creation event, at the very beginning of that narrow window of time, carefully prepared by billions of years of life that previously preceded us, which means that God intends to fulfill his purpose through humanity in the next few thousand years or less. So that's the good news. We don't have to put up with this miserable universe for more than a few thousand years. We'll get to experience a much better one that will follow. This is the universe that God creates to bring about the conquest of evil, and that's something that's not in this catalog. All this catalog looks at is a design you need to prepare a home for human beings. What we're planning to do is prepare another catalog that looks at everything you've got to design in order for human beings to see this design. The universe has been exquisitely designed so that human beings can observe it in significant detail. That's a whole other argument for design. But the most powerful argument for design of all, we live in a universe that's been exquisitely fine-tuned to enable Christ to bring about a rapid, efficient conquest of evil. And that's the message of this book, is that God designed his universe to bring about the end of evil. And with the end of evil, we'll replace the universe with a much better universe. But I can tell you as an astronomer, it's really hard for me to imagine the physics that would be necessary to make a better universe. We're out of time.
Hang your heads in shame. So, yeah, that's right. I'm going to leave it. Where is it? Anyway? Okay, it's on the treat table back there. So please clear your conscience for the new year.
You know, what Ross is saying is critical. They're going to put us in a smaller room. Now, can you imagine putting all these people in a smaller room? They'll do that. Yeah. which means we're not going to fit. And the only way we get to keep this room is for everybody to sign the attendance sheet, okay? So if some of you are guests here, do us a favor and sign that attendance sheet. But I'll bet you this. I'll bet you the guest sign and the regulars did. That's a prophecy I'm making, but anyway, please do that, because I also like this room because of the fact I can use PowerPoint here. If we go to a smaller room, that probably isn't going to work. So please do that. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the privilege of gathering together here Sunday by Sunday to study your books. Thank you that you've given us several books that corroborate one another and step by step convince us and persuade us that you're there, that you love us, that you revealed yourself clearly to us, and you've shown us a way by which we can come into salvation, a redeemed relationship with you. Father, this is the new year we're entering into, a time when people are making plans for the future, and Lord, I pray that you give each one of us in this class the opportunity to be a messenger, as it says in Romans 10, a teacher and a preacher, to guide people through their mental roadblocks, to receive of your light, your love, life, and truth, that they too may enjoy an eternal relationship with the one that created them and created this beautiful universe in which we can live. In Jesus' name, amen.